is a major force in fandom for sharing gifts and stories and challenges. It was once, however, an even more central player. Today, we're going to explore the facts surrounding the Tumblr porn purge of 2018, as well as some of the theories surrounding why it happened. I'll put on my Professor Flame hat to explore some of the sociological foundations of purity purges. And then Ferret will give us some thoughts on kind of where we go from here as a community.
First, we're going to start with a kind of quick and dirty timeline of the things that played into the Tumblr purge. We've collected all the information we could about this. If you feel like we've missed anything, you can add it in. And this information is going to be available on the website as well. So first of all, on the 18th of April, 2018, the FOSTA-SESTA was signed into law. And that changed the responsibility of hosts of content on the internet, as opposed to putting all the responsibility on creators and sharers of content. We'll go into more detail about that in a minute as well.
And then a couple months later, in November of that year, Tumblr was removed from the Apple App Store for hosting illegal images, which were indecent images of children. And this is confirmed in a statement from Tumblr themselves.
Later that month, or throughout that month, random tags seemed to appear and disappear. Blogs were deleted without warning, without explanation. And Tumblr didn't really give a solid explanation for what was allowed and what wasn't allowed. The rules at the time still allowed sexual content. They didn't tell us that anything was changing about that, but there was a lot of upheaval as things seemed to disappear and reappear without any guidelines.
And then on December 3rd of 2018, Tumblr announced that a full ban of not safe for work content would come into place on December 17th. This would include real life images of genitals or, and this is my favorite phrase, female presenting nipples. It would also include all images of sex acts, including illustrations. Still allowed was, quote, exposed female presenting nipples in connection with breastfeeding, birth, or afterbirth moments, and health related situations such as post-mastectomy or gender confirmation surgery, end quote, as well as, quote, written content such as erotica, nudity related to political or newsworthy speech, and nudity found in art such as sculptures and illustrations, end quote.
On December 17th of that year, the ban came into place. Tumblr started flagging, blocking, deleting blogs and posts that were in apparent violation. A lot of it was run by an automatic filter, which was not great, and we'll talk about the filters in a minute as well. Even Tumblr's own post about which images were still allowed was flagged.
And then on August 12th of 2019, it was announced that Tumblr was sold to a company called Automatic, who owns WordPress, so you're familiar with them on that level, and Automatic confirmed that the ban would stay in place.
And that's kind of where we are now. Not a whole lot has changed since then. Obviously, a lot of people are still upset about the ban, but there's been no word from Automatic or Tumblr if anything is going to change. So to go back to the beginning, we're going to talk about the FOSTA-SESTA law. This is a U.S. law, and since Tumblr is a U.S.-based company, they are responsible under this law. Also, disclaimer, I'm not a lawyer. This is my understanding of it. If anyone is a lawyer and wants to talk to us about laws relating to fandom, we'd love to hear from you. But this messes with Section 230 of a 1996 addition to the Communications Decency Act. And the Act states, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. So what that means is that if a company like Twitter has a tweet that say anti-Trump and Trump wants to sue somebody, he can't sue Twitter. He could only go after the specific person that created that tweet. And whether that was a legal attack or not is a separate matter, but Twitter could not be held responsible. That changes under SESTA-FOSTA. Now, those providers are responsible for any sex work advertisements that are hosted on their site servers, whether they created the content, whether they know the content is there or not. This is a huge change, because now they have to be aware of all of the content on their site or they could be held accountable for it. The goal of SESTA-FOSTA was supposed to prevent sex trafficking. That's how it was marketed, at least. But the actual implication is that Twitter, Tumblr, Craigslist, Facebook now become responsible if any sex work is being negotiated through their platform at all. This is utterly terrifying for content hosts, and it's a slippery slope for them being responsible for a lot of extremely illegal stuff that they honestly have very little control over. How can you possibly monitor all the content on a server as massive as Tumblr or Facebook or Twitter? Every single tweet someone writes, as soon as someone says, "I'm offering sex and here's how much" on Twitter, Twitter is now legally exposed. So, what's the answer to that? Well, a broad ban is easier for a company to enact and to pitch as a reasonable effort to adhere to this law than targeted filtering. It's sort of hard to say, you can talk about sex, but you can't put a price on it. Or you can talk about sex with a price on it in theory, but not about real people. And those kind of lines lead us into talking about the filters. So for the filter, the way Tumblr did it before was the only thing that they really worried about, or the only thing that they were legally obligated to filter through, was known child pornography content. And the way that works is there is actually a database that some people, I feel very sorry for, are in charge of maintaining through law enforcement agencies, where known abusive child content is saved. And companies have filters that compare new content that's posted on their site to these databases to make sure that there's no match, and that can be done automatically. But Tumblr, through an audit, found that something got missed. And when it became knowledge within the spheres that would have access to that information, Apple took them off the Apple Store, basically saying, until your filter is better, you can't be on the Apple Store because we can't guarantee nobody's going to come across that. So now they're stuck needing to improve their filters for child pornography, and they also are now being beheld to a new law that says any sex work advertisements are going to be their problem as well. So how do you filter data? Well, it's really, really hard. The most accurate way is to use human filters, obviously. A person can click through every single post that's made on all of Tumblr and say approved or unapproved. I think we can all see the automatic problem with that, which is that a huge amount of data is posted on Tumblr every day, every hour, even every minute, and that's extremely expensive to pay people to do. Tumblr does not have a lot of money. In addition, if they're looking for content that's harm against children, that can be really traumatic for people. And that is a job some people have, and I'm glad there are people out there protecting children by doing that, but it's not something that's great for your mental health, so hiring people to do that is potentially damaging for those people as well. So we say, okay, well, we'll teach a robot to do it instead. There's a lot of problems with teaching a robot to filter content. Neural networks are great and a lot of times super powerful, and the stuff that we can do with computers and filtering is amazing. But in this case, you're trying to teach it something that has an inherentness that's hard for a computer to understand. So to demonstrate this, we want to point your attention to a Tumblr blog called lewisandquark.tumblr.com, which we will obviously be linking in the show notes along with a couple of our favorite posts. But on this blog, an AI scientist trains neural networks to come up with names for things like paint colors or off-Broadway musicals, and post the results of what the neural network comes up with based on which different parameters it's given.
And for anyone who doesn't know what a neural network is, because you are not an AI nerd, what we're talking about is a really, really, really baby version of Tony's Jarvis.
Yes, exactly. It's a learning algorithm. You give it a whole bunch of data. It compares all the data and says, yeah, I can come up with an average of this data, and then pretends it knows what it's talking about and spews out an answer. Jarvis is impossible for what technology we have for neural networks now. If you ever played with chatbot or something like that, that's kind of like the linguistic learning algorithm version of Jarvis. If you squish all these things together, you kind of get a Jarvis. So this one, we picked a couple of our favorites to give you an idea of how this neural network approaches coming up with averages of lists of things. So the first one is that it was given a list of names of burlesque shows and asked to come up with its own names for burlesque shows. And these are a few of our favorites. Farty Fasties, a burlesque show. Peepsing Tarts burlesque show. My favorite, The Pants of Fame Burlesque Adventure. I just love how it threw adventure in there. And then Flame's favorite, My Rear's on the Sexy.
Guys, do you know what that means? Because I don't.
They ended up liking My Rear's on the Sexy so much that the that they hosted a show a couple years ago that was called My Rear Is on the Sexy. So you can go see the art that was done for that. But then possibly my favorite ever Lewis and Quark post was the Portland Guinea Pig Rescue gave them a list of every guinea pig they'd ever rescued, the names of their own pet guinea pigs, and then all the guinea pig names they could find online. And then they lined up all their current adoptable guinea pigs and asked the neural network to name those guinea pigs based on the names they'd already given. And so there's a whole list, and you should definitely click and check them out. But a couple of our favorites: Pop Chop and Fuzzable, Buzzberry and After Pie, Sniffkit and Hanger Dan. As you can see, it kind of gets it, especially if you look at the difference between the burlesque show ones and the guinea pig ones. It's not spewing out nonsense. It understands the point. Pop Chop and Fuzzable definitely sound like potential guinea pig names, but as humans, we know they're not. And this is the fundamental problem with trying to teach robots how to find porn. What makes porn porn? If it's just a lot of skin tone, well, they're also marking sand dunes. And you can kind of see why. It looks like a lot of skin tone. The difference between a sand dune and a lot of skin tone actually turns out to be something that pretty much only people can distinguish, or at least it would take a very advanced AI to solve that problem. So Tumblr was overmarking or undermarking, and the first few months were plagued mostly with overmarking. Now we can see some of the filters are getting better because they do learn. The more data we give them, the more they learn. And every time something was unflagged, they said to the neural network, "Hey, buddy, you got this one wrong." But robots still think the deserts look like naked people, and they kind of do. So it's really hard to teach them the difference. A lot of people on Tumblr have clearly figured this out already. If you draw porn with no skin tone colors, like if you make everybody blue, for example, it's unlikely to get caught. Fundamentally, robots don't understand sex. And this is not a shade at any robot fandoms. I'm sure your advanced sexy robots are wonderful and have fulfilling sex lives, but Tumblr's robots do not understand sex. And Tumblr, as we will get to again later, has very little money, and these are programs you have to pay for. So if the robots suck, what do we rely on? And even if the robots don't suck, how do we teach them where the line falls? Because even if our filters were perfect, we still have to somehow define the difference between what counts as porn and what's not. So if the robots do the first pass, and then we appeal those, because that's an option, the idea is that next a human looks at it. And we see yet another breakdown of how to enforce a policy like this. Because regardless of how good the robots are doing, even if they're doing a terrible job, if the people driving them can't draw the line, how do we decide what's in and out? How do we draw the line between porn and artful nudity? They say that artful nudity is allowed. But if I post a sketch from a life drawing class of a naked woman with her female presenting nips sticking out and everything, that's clearly art. But what if she's got a hip cocked? What if she's smiling? What if she's licking her lips? What if she's looking right at the viewer with a sultry expression and her clothes are in a puddle on the floor? Is it porn now? The only difference between porn and art really is an intent to titillate, and it's impossible to decipher intent from viewing the final piece. So it's gotta come down to the personal judgment of the person who's making the final call. Do you feel titillated? And is that a fair way to police content? Everybody's line is different. To have a stable community, you need concrete, predictable rules. And it's impossible to know where the line has been drawn for us as users.
And one of the problems with asking really any company in the United States to have conversations regarding bodies is that the United States is, as a culture, very sex phobic. So I actually have a PhD in sociology, and I've studied a lot of things like this. So over the next bunch of episodes and perhaps the life of the podcast, I will occasionally put on my Professor Flame hat and step back and hopefully help us understand some of the underpinnings of why things work the way they work from a sociological academic perspective. So today, this really fits well. The idea of sex phobia is an important concept to unpack. While the US is certainly one of the most sex phobic countries in the understood Western world, we aren't alone in our fear of women. Briefly, and assume this is true for every time we talk about anything with sex in the history of the podcast, The history of womanhood has been tied to the realities of menstruation. Blood in ancient times was connected to sacrifice and deities and sometimes demons and possession. But the sacrifice and the idea of deities, we could have easily gone with the assumption that women were goddesses when they bled monthly. And there are some cultures that did. Sadly, the ones that we inherited from didn't, specifically the we being the United States. And I can't speak for Canada. I don't study Canada, but perhaps Ferret will see some of this in her Canadian brain, perhaps the country that you call home, you see this as well, perhaps you don't. I can speak for the United States that we got the inheritance of the ones that were afraid of women. When women are a secondary class of human, therefore, they're in charge of bearing children and protecting them as the ones what were raising the next generation. Because having children is the primary goal of most biological creatures, women have to be protected at all costs, whether the women need protecting or not. So for example, before we had menstruation products that helped women become mobile during menstruation, there were all sorts of ways in which women were sequestered on a certain level during that period of time. So way back in ancient times where people were tribal and living in deserts and moving around, there was literally tents where women sat on piles of hay. We have evidence that the piles of hay business extended through really until about the 1800s for some classes of women in some areas of the world. So if you're sitting on a pile of hay for 4 days, it's really hard to get anything else done. I personally have not tried it, but it sounds restricting. So because of that, women can't be quote unquote full members of a productive society, as it were. They can't be in leadership because these 4, 5, 8, 9, 10 days a month, they're going to be sitting on hay. And instead of re-examining any of those things when we started making sanitary pads, and I mean, as primitive as they were back in my grandmother's generation, where there was belts and buckles and everything else involved, we never really stopped to examine any of this. And now, I mean, menstruation is still a massive, massive issue, but we're certainly mobile during it most of the time, at least. However, it also reminds people that the woman's body's primary function, in according to the culture, is to reproduce the next generation. So this is fundamentally where we get purity culture from. And this is a belief that the purity of the womb and the reproductive choices of women are actually public property. In the United States and a whole heap of other places, this also runs parallel to the fact that we are also a rape culture, where men are believed to be the default possessors of truth, and women are assumed to be the emotional vessels for bearing children. So we are terrified of women who want to have sex for reasons other than bearing children, and we're terrified of sex without childbearing possibilities, full stop, because it doesn't fit into this binary that historically the culture has absorbed, created, and perpetuated. In fandom, where we've created things like MPreg and we celebrate queer realities of all stripes, this has taken on a less feminized, but no less weaponized reality. By policing the joy of others, all we are saying is that their choices are public property, that we get a say in their joy because we get a say in the sex lives of others, because we get a say in the reproduction of the next generation. So the Tumblr purge comes from a fundamental inheritance of the puritanical foundations upon which America was founded. The heterosexual missionary position behind closed doors and only talk to us about bodies as sexual objects when we can talk about wombs. We can't talk about breastfeeding, for example, because boobs. And we don't know what to do with women are sexual creatures and also bearing children. So the more we get Tumblr purges and the more we get like cries of like, think of the children, and we get calls to ban fictional ships, the more we're policing pleasure on subjects we honestly, as a giant culture, have no business talking about. All creatures are communal and we're shaped by our culture, and in turn, we shape our culture. Fandom is an international entity, and we are all bringing not only our nationally dominant cultures to the table, but our personally constructed ones. So like, y'all, there are lots of elements of this we really, really cannot unpack right now. But what we do know for sure is that in the United States, we have no idea how to talk about sex. We don't know how to talk about pleasure. We don't know how to talk about joy. We know how to talk about productivity, work, and profit margins. So we will never know what to do with sexual pleasure on a cultural scale. And that's why fandom needs to continue to be countercultural by celebrating consensual joy, or non-con, if that's your kink, properly tagged in fictional settings, et cetera, et cetera. But we got to celebrate joy wherever we can find it. This is one of the things that makes the Tumblr thing so frustrating, because that was a place where that was happening. But when corporations, money, and the dominant purity culture of the United States kind of get involved, this is where things get really, really messy.
So what does that mean for us as a community, and how should we feel about Tumblr now? Well, we can't know for sure what went on behind closed doors at Tumblr HQ. There's clearly a lot of things that went into this. It's possible that they didn't have the resources to better their child pornography filters, and they couldn't add new ones for the FOSTA-SESTA problem, and that the blanket approach was the only way they could feasibly manage handling the laws that are in place. There's a period of time where they were blocking tags and deleting blogs, and everyone was confused, and maybe they were confused, because how do you put an age on an alien on a sexy table? Is a robot having sex with a sentient plant bestiality? So it's easier and lazier, but also cheaper and simpler to ban everything that looks like sex than to figure out where to draw the line in the sand, which of course brings us back to that personal judgment issue. But it's also possible they were under pressure from people who wanted to buy them, because we do know that just a little over a year later, or less than a year after the ban, they were bought. And it's possible that the people in charge of Tumblr at Yahoo had given up on caring about Tumblr and wanted the quickest, easiest way to appease the largest, richest group of people and protect their legal asses. But ultimately, regardless of why they did it, we as a fandom don't have the power to undo it. So we're left to pick up the pieces and figure out what it means for us. There's a pervasive sense of unsafety in fandom on Tumblr right now, because as Tumblr has shown, the filters are unpredictable, which means we can't police our own content to make sure we stay unflagged. And also, if they're willing to chop off a huge part of the user base at a moment's notice, what's next? Is written content with sex next? Talking about sex at all? Talking about gender? What's the next law that's going to completely change how the rest of the world interacts with these content providers that are based in the US? But this is akin to the feeling that was fandom in the 90s and early 2000s. Fandom archives were all individually hosted by a person or a group of people who paid to keep the server up. Any day, someone could wake up and cancel their hosting account, delete the site and everybody's content, and walk away. It happened. Sometimes it happened without notice. Groups of people would fight, split up, make new sites. There's a lot of drama you can find out there, complete records of all kinds of major fandom archive breakdowns. And content was also always judged on a personal level. Ship wars translated into content purges, bans, and drama. You were beholden to a single people or a small group of dedicated fan people who made no money off the choice to host your content and could therefore make any decisions about it that they wanted. And then we started moving more corporate, more businessy, these bigger bases for fandom. There was LiveJournal, and you could go read about Strike Through and Bolt Through. There's fanfiction.net. And you can go read about all of the fanfiction bands of the 2000s, because they hit a lot of them in a row. And there's been hundreds. I'm going to link a Tumblr post about the history of content bans in fandom in the show notes. And you should just, even if you just scroll through it and have a look, you'll see that this coming from Tumblr is not a new thing to happen to fandom. So being beholden to corporations doesn't really change anything, except it adds money to the equation while increasing a sense of safety. When a large company disappoints us now, it feels less inevitable and more like a slap in the face. We trusted them. We made money for them. And of course, the community gets fractured. It's inevitable. And yes, new social medias will rise and fall and communities will reform, but it doesn't mean that the fracturing now isn't painful. Just because we know that this happens and will continue to happen in fandom doesn't mean that we shouldn't grieve what we've lost. We're mourning the loss of content we valued, friends who left, connections we had formed that are gone now. We had a platform to be heard, to share, to celebrate what we loved about sex, and that's disappearing. And the grief comes out as anger sometimes. If you want to check out the notes on literally any post from the staff blog since the announcement, you can get some cathartic rage out by reading what other people are saying. I'm sure it's tough to be the Tumblr staff blog social media person right now, but I also understand having little sympathy for a company that's done this. It also comes out as sadness sometimes. A lot of people are just sort of disappearing out of just sadness, disappointment. Sometimes the grief's a motivator for new places, though. Look at Pillowfort. It rapidly exploded due to the loss of Tumblr, and they're moving at a much faster pace in terms of garnering new people and expanding because of that. The fact that this happens a lot doesn't change how much it hurts. And the fact that it'll happen again doesn't mean we shouldn't look for new homes that offer safety for us now. Ultimately, yes, fandom lives on, and we can't always control the politics or the money or the companies that have this control over our living spaces, especially for those of us who are not in the US, but are still using companies that are beholden to US law. But you know what? Whether you're in the US or not, vote. Global culture has an impact too. Wherever you are, vote. Pay attention to these things. Something like a sex trafficking law might not feel like it could have an impact on the platforms where you share a porn of two superheroes going at it, but it can. But really, day to day, we're not in control. And it's okay to grieve that, and it's okay to be scared. We can learn how to protect ourselves to the best that we can. We can learn how to protect our content. We can also keep fostering the connections that form fandoms that we can move on and rebuild when these sorts of things happen. Because remember, Asgard is a people, not a place. And so is fandom.